the new controlling shareholder of HSN had excellent connections in the cable industry. Maybe HSN could be aired on cable stations directly without using Silver King's stations. Then, Silver King would be left with nothing but a network of major market television stations reaching 27.5 million homes. Hey, that didn't sound too bad either. What happened? After a few months of trading in the $5 area, Silver King moved up to trading in the $10 to $20 range over the next year. This was due partly to the lifting of the usual post-spin-off selling pressure, and partly to speculation, reported in the Wall Street Journal, that Silver King was considering joining with others to form a fifth television network. Several years later, Barry Diller, the well-known media mogul, took control of Silver King to use it as a platform for his new media empire. Certainly, I didn't buy Silver King anticipating this particular series of events. However, buying an ignored property at a low price allowed a lot of room for good things to happen, and for value to be ultimately recognized. Oh yes, home shopping also had some interesting price movement after the spinoff. Its stock actually went up the day the Silver King spinoff was distributed to HSN shareholders. Usually when a spinoff worth 50 cents per share, one-tenth of a share of Silver King selling at $5 per share, is made to the parent company's shareholders, the parent company's shares should fall about 50 cents on the day of the distribution. Instead, Home Shopping's stock went up 25 cents per share. If you owned Home Shopping Network stock on the day prior to the distribution, the very next day you were actually paid for the privilege of taking Silver King shares off its hands. The combined value of Home Shopping Network stock and the spun-off Silver King shares created a one-day gain of 12% for HSN shareholders. No matter what the academics may say about the efficiency of the stock market, clearly there are still plenty of inefficiently priced opportunities available. To investors who know where to look, that is. I almost forgot. Remember Precision Systems? You know, the money-making loser of call processing systems that HSN spun off before Silver King? Well, I'm still trying to forget. I never looked at it. After being spun off and trading below $1 per share for several months, within a year the stock traded to $5 and then doubled again over the next 2 years. You can't win them all, but it would be nice. The Ten Commandments. One of the Ten Commandments is, honor thy father and thy mother. So logically it follows that paying attention to parents is a good thing. As it happens, the same advice also seems to work well with the parents of spin-offs. Coincidence? I think not. In the home shopping situation, although I was attracted to it partially due to the spin-off, after reading the Smart Money article and doing some of my own work, I decided to also buy stock in the parent, Home Shopping Network. At a purchase price of $5 before the Silver King spinoff, this worked out to a net purchase price of $4.50 per share after subtracting the initial trading value of Silver King. Looking at the spinoff highlighted the fact that the parent company, Home Shopping Network, was trading at a cheap price. Also, looking at the investment merits of home shopping caused me, for comparison purposes, to study its main rival, QVC Network. While I felt home shopping was cheap, QVC actually looked even cheaper. Both stocks turned out to be doubles in the next year. The point here is not to tell you about some more big winners. Believe me, I've had my share of losers. The point is that looking at a parent company that is about to be stripped clean of a complicated division can lead to some pretty interesting opportunities. Having said that, let's charge ahead. Case study. American Express, Lehman Brothers. In January 1994, in a widely heralded move, American Express announced its intention to spin off its Lehman Brothers subsidiary as an independent company. The Lehman Brothers spinoff was actually the vestiges of an old-line Wall Street investment banking partnership that American Express had purchased in the early 1980s. At the time of the purchase, under the leadership of a previous CEO, the idea was to turn American Express into a financial supermarket. Since after a decade of trying, no one could figure out what this meant, the board of American Express had decided to spin off the remains of Lehman to shareholders. When the appropriate filings were made in April 1994, I decided to take a closer look at the new Lehman Brothers. According to the filings and extensive newspaper accounts, Lehman Brothers had the highest expenses per dollar of revenue in the investment industry, had lost money in the last year, and had an extremely volatile earnings history. In addition, insiders, while highly paid as far as salaries and bonuses were concerned, held relatively few shares of stock in the new spinoff. In most companies, and especially on Wall Street, employees act to maximize their compensation. The senior executives of Lehman did not have most of their net worth tied to the fortunes of Lehman's stock. My translation, there was a good chance that when it came time to split up profits between employees and shareholders, shareholders would lose. You know the drill. Two for me, one for you, one for you, two for me, etc. Unless or until Lehman traded at a big discount to book value and to other investment firms, I wasn't going to be that interested. But something else caught my eye. According to newspaper accounts, one problem with American Express had been that large institutional investors had no idea what its earnings were going to be for any given period. The main culprit was Lehman's volatile earnings track record. The only thing Wall Street hates more than bad news is uncertainty. Overcoming the problem of unpredictable earnings was precisely the goal of the Lehman spinoff. This was also the reasoning behind American Express's earlier sale of its Shearson subsidiary. After the spinoff, American Express would be down to two main businesses, both of which appeared to be less volatile than Lehman. The first business, categorized by American Express as travel-related services, included the well-known charge card and the world's largest travel agency, as well as the traveler's check business. Under the new CEO, the plan was to concentrate on and develop these core franchises. Although competition from Visa and MasterCard had eroded some of American Express's business over the last several years, it appeared that much of the problem was due to management inattention. There was clearly going to be a new focus on the basic businesses. As American Express's main product was a charge card requiring full payment every month, its revenues were largely based on fees paid by cardholders and merchants. This seemed more attractive than the credit card business, which required undertaking greater credit risk. In short, American Express appeared to have a niche in the higher end of the market, with a franchise and brand name that was very hard, if not impossible, to duplicate. The second business, Investors Diversified Services, IDS, had been growing its earnings at a 20% rate for almost 10 years. This business consisted of a nationwide group of financial planners who provided clients with overall investment and insurance plans based on the client's individual needs. The planners often recommended and sold many of the company's own product offerings, such as annuities and mutual funds. Since the financial planning business is a largely unregulated business dominated by single or small group practitioners, IDS, now American Express Advisors, was able to provide the comfort, resources, and depth of financial products not easily found in other organizations. This ability to provide services all in one package has allowed IDS to grow its assets under management at a very fast rate. Its revenues were largely derived from the annual fees generated from the investment and insurance products sold to its customers. The bottom line was, IDS also seemed like a valuable and fast-growing niche business. The exciting thing was that for several months before the spinoff of Lehman Brothers in May 1994, you could buy American Express at a price of $29 per share or less. This price included the value of the Lehman spinoff, estimated in the newspapers to be worth $3 to $5 per American Express share. This meant that the new post-spinoff American Express was actually being created for a price between $24 and $26 per share. Since published estimates were that American Express would earn approximately $2.65 per share for 1994 without Lehman Brothers, this worked out to a purchase price of less than 10 times earnings. A look in Valueline at some large credit card companies showed their average PE to be in the low teens. Although I wasn't sure this was the perfect comparison, it appeared that American Express could be priced, on a relative basis, as much as 30 to 40% too low, even though the main charge card business under previous management had suffered some reversals. A new focus on American Express's irreplaceable brand name and high-end market niche gave me some comfort. Also, as previously mentioned, the fee-based nature of American Express's charge card and related businesses seemed more attractive than the greater credit risks being undertaken by the credit card companies I was using for comparison. Certainly, IDS, which accounted for approximately 30% of American Express's income, looked like a business worth much more than only 10 times earnings. After growing at 20% per year for such a long time, and having a steady income stream from the assets under management, buying this business at a huge discount to the market multiple of between 14 and 15 seemed like a steal. Although American Express also owned an international bank, most probably worth just 10 times earnings, this accounted for less than 10% of its total profits. The bottom line was, at less than 10 times earnings, American Express looked very cheap. Once Lehman's confusing and volatile earnings were removed from the picture, I thought that this would become evident to other investors. The only question was, since I wasn't that interested in Lehman, should I buy stock in American Express before or after the spinoff was completed? As a general rule, even if institutional investors are attracted to a parent company because an undesirable business is being spun off, they will wait until after the spinoff is completed before buying stock in the parent. This practice relieves the institution from having to sell the stock of the unwanted spinoff and removes the risk of the spinoff transaction not being completed. Often, institutional buying of the parent stock immediately after a spinoff has a tendency to drive the price up. That's why, if the parent company appears to be an attractive investment, it is usually worthwhile to buy stock in the parent before the spinoff takes place. Although it is a little more trouble to create the bargain purchase by buying stock in the parent before the spinoff is completed, it is usually worth the extra effort, even if you don't get a great price when selling the spinoff shares. In Lehman's case, since I was happy to create American Express at a price between $24 and $26, it was an easy decision to buy it at $29 before the spinoff. The Lehman stock, which I ended up keeping, I hate selling spinoffs, started trading at about $18.50 per share. As one share of Lehman was distributed for every 5 shares of American Express owned, this worked out to a value of about $3.75 per American Express share. American Express stock did rise 1/5 the first day of trading after the Lehman distribution, so buying before the spinoff was a good move. It was also a good move for the long term. American Express proceeded to reach $36 per share in the first year after the spinoff, for a gain of over 40% in 1 year. By the way, a little over 6 months after the spinoff, Warren Buffett announced that he had purchased just under 10% of American Express. Apparently, the spinoff and sale of unrelated businesses had unmasked American Express to be a Warren Buffett company, a compelling bargain with a strong brand name and an attractive market niche. See? Paying attention to parents. Who'da thunk it? Partial spinoffs. I never like to work too hard to understand an investment, so if a potential investment is too complicated or difficult to understand, I'd rather skip it and find something easier to figure out. That's why this next area, partial spinoffs, is so attractive to me. Here is an area where boning up on first grade math skills, especially subtraction, is the key to success. In a partial spinoff transaction, a company decides to spin off or sell only a portion of one of its divisions. Instead of spinning off 100% ownership in a division to its shareholders, only a portion of the division's stock is distributed to parent company shareholders or sold to the general public. The parent company retains the remainder of the division's stock. For example, if XYZ Corporation distributes a 20% interest in its widget division to its shareholders, 20% of Widget's outstanding shares will trade publicly, while 80% will still be owned by XYZ. Companies may pursue a partial spin-off strategy for several reasons. Sometimes a corporation may need to raise capital. Selling off a portion of a division while still retaining management control may be an attractive option. At other times, the motivation for pursuing a partial spin-off is to highlight a particular division's true value to the marketplace. Its value may be masked when buried among the parent company's other businesses. A separate stock price for that division enables investors to value the division independently. It also allows for incentive compensation for the division's managers to be based directly on divisional performance. The benefits of investigating partial spin-offs are twofold. First, in the case where shares in the partial spin-off are distributed directly to parent company shareholders, spin-off shares should perform well for most of the same reasons that 100% spin-offs do. In the case where a partial stake in a division is sold directly to the public through an initial public offering known as an IPO, your opportunity is probably not as good. This is because the people who buy stock in the public offering are not being handed stock they don't want. A stock price depressed by indiscriminate selling is therefore not likely. Your second opportunity comes from something else. Here's where you break out your first grade math skills. Once the stock of the partial spin-off is publicly trading, the market has effectively valued the spun-off division. If the widget division of XYZ Corporation has 10 million shares outstanding and 2 million are sold to the public for $20 per share, that means XYZ still owns 8 million shares of widget. The value of those shares works out to $160 million. 8 million shares multiplied by a $20 share price. Okay, second grade math. Now comes your second opportunity. By doing this simple math, you now know two things. Of course, you know the value of XYZ's 80% stake in Widget, $160 million. However, you also know the value the market places on all the rest of XYZ's businesses. That value is equal to the market value of XYZ less $160 million. Here's how it works. If XYZ has a market value of $500 million and its 80% widget stake is valued by the market at $160 million, that implies a net value of $340 million for the rest of XYZ's businesses. Where will that little piece of trivia get you? Let's see. Case study: The Cheaper Side of Sears. In September 1992, Sears announced its intention to sell a 20% stake in two of its subsidiaries to the public. Sears's management had been under pressure to improve the performance of its stock price for years. It was Sears's contention that the value of the two subsidiaries, Dean Witter, including Discover, and Allstate Insurance, was not adequately reflected in Sears' stock price. In the case of Dean Witter, Sears also announced its intention to distribute its remaining 80% interest directly to shareholders at a later date, sometime in 1993.
Why was this interesting?
After all, before the announcement, Sears was a conglomerate that owned Dean Witter, Allstate, and the well-known department store chain. It was no secret that Sears had owned all of these businesses for years. Sears was widely followed by Wall Street analysts. So why, all of a sudden, was this an investment opportunity? Sears was merely selling or distributing businesses it already owned. The answer is that not only was Sears going to be highlighting the market value of Dean Witter and Allstate through the public trading of these two divisions, it was also going to be revealing something else. By taking Sears' stock price and subtracting the market value of its remaining stakes in Dean Witter and Allstate, a value for the rest of Sears' assets, primarily the department store, could be calculated. Big deal? A very big deal. Let's see why. A 20% stake in Dean Witter was sold by Sears in February 1993. Sears's stated intention was to spin off, by a distribution directly to Sears shareholders, its remaining 80% interest in Dean Witter in the next several months. In the beginning of June, Sears sold a 20% stake in Allstate for $27 a share. By the beginning of July, just before Sears' distribution of its remaining stake in Dean Witter, this is how things stood. Dean Witter's stock was trading at approximately $37 per share. Allstate stock was trading around $29. Sears' stock stood at about $54. The math worked like this. Sears had announced that it would distribute its remaining 80% stake in Dean Witter. According to the announcement, this meant that, for every 100 shares of Sears, a distribution of 40 shares of Dean Witter would be made. Sears was distributing 136 million shares of Dean Witter, and had approximately 340 million shares outstanding. So the distribution ratio was 136 to 340, or 0.4. Therefore, in mid-July, each Sears shareholder would receive shares in Dean Witter worth approximately 0.4, the announced distribution ratio, multiplied by $37, the trading price of Dean Witter's stock, or approximately $15 worth of Dean Witter stock for each share of Sears owned. Since Sears was trading at $54 per share before the distribution, this translated to a net price of $39 for the remainder of Sears. What was that remainder? Primarily, it was Sears' remaining 80% stake in Allstate, its foreign and domestic department store business, and various real estate businesses, including Coldwell Banker. However, we also knew something else. The market value of Sears' 80% stake in Allstate. Sears owned approximately 340 million shares of Allstate. Sears itself also happened to have approximately 340 million shares outstanding. This meant that if you owned a share of Sears, you also indirectly owned a share of Allstate. With Allstate at about $29, for about $10 per share, $39 net stock price, less $29 price of Allstate, you were getting the foreign and domestic Sears department store business and its real estate business. Was this a bargain? Michael Price, a well-known fund manager, sure thought so. In a Barron's interview, July 5, 1993, he laid out the case straightforwardly. That $54 a share includes one share of Allstate, which is at $28, so that leaves $26. Then you get a 0.4 share of Dean Witter, which is $15. That leaves $10 or $11. About $2 or $3 of that is Sears Mexico and Sears Canada. That leaves about $8. Coldwell Banker is worth $2 or $3 a share. So that leaves $5 a share, or a market cap of about $1.5 billion for the retailer, with $27 billion in sales. The new management seems very focused. It's an almost debt-free retailer with huge real estate opportunities. I told you, I never like to work too hard to understand an investment. A quick check revealed that indeed Price was right. Sears was cheap. With $27 billion in sales and 340 million shares outstanding, Sears had $79 per share in sales. If those sales could be purchased for $5 a share, pretty much debt-free, then that worked out to a purchase price of just over 6% of sales. 5 divided by 79. On the other hand, a look at JCPenney showed sales of about $78 per share, and a market price of about $44 per share. That was over 56% of sales. Of course, there are many other measures of relative value, earnings for instance, but all indications were that the domestic retail business of Sears could be created at an incredibly cheap price. By the way, although I am a strong advocate of doing your own work, this doesn't mean I'm against stealing other people's ideas. It's a big world out there. You can't begin to cover everything yourself. That's why if you read about an investment situation that falls into one of the categories covered in this book, it's often productive to take a closer look. if either the logic of the situation is compelling, or the advice comes from a short list of reliable experts, to be named later, stealing can be a profitable practice. Of course, stealing refers to stealing an idea, technically without the use of deadly force. Unfortunately, you still have to do your own homework. In the Sears case, in addition to the Barron's article, Michael Price gave a similar interview to Fortune magazine in mid-June. So even if you hadn't followed the Sears spinoff story for the many months it appeared in the business press, or you followed the story but neglected to do the math yourself, there were at least two widely available opportunities to pirate a good idea. If you know the types of situation you're looking for, such as partial spinoffs, these type of opportunities are much easier to spot. Buying Sears stock also worked out quite well. We'll get to some losers later. After the Dean Witter distribution, the $39 remaining investment in Sears was up 50% over the next several months. Allstate was only up from $29 to $33 during this period. Obviously, the market finally took notice of the inherent value of Sears' other assets. For the advanced students, yes, it was possible to simultaneously buy Sears stock and short Allstate stock, creating only the portion of Sears that was clearly a bargain. In some cases, this is a smart way to play, especially when the value of the cheap portion, a $5 per share department store purchase, is a small part of the purchase price. $39 post-Dean Witter distribution. However, in this case, the disparity between the bargain purchase price of the department store segment and true value was so huge, no such fancy tactics were necessary. Insider Tips, a do-it-yourself guide. Insiders, I may have already mentioned that looking to see what insiders are doing is a good way to find attractive spin-off opportunities. Okay, so maybe I've beaten you over the head with it. The thinking is that if insiders own a large amount of stock or options, their interests and the interests of shareholders will be closely aligned. But did you know there are times when insiders may benefit when a spin-off trades at a low price? Did you know there are some situations where insiders come out ahead when you don't buy stock in a new spin-off? Did you know you could gain a large advantage by spotting these situations? Well, it's all true. Spin-offs are a unique animal. In the usual case, when a company first sells stock publicly, an elaborate negotiation takes place. The underwriter, the investment firm that takes a company public, and the owners of the company engage in a discussion about the price at which the company's stock should be sold in its initial offering. Although the price is set based on market factors, in most cases there is a good deal of subjectivity involved. The company's owners want the stock to be sold at a high price so that the most money will be raised. The underwriter will usually prefer a lower price, so that investors who buy stock in the offering can make some money. That way, the next new issue they underwrite will be easier to sell. In any event, an arm's-length negotiation takes place, and a price is set. In a spin-off situation, no such discussion takes place. Instead, shares of a spin-off are distributed directly to parent company shareholders, and the spin-off's price is left to market forces. Often, management's incentive stock option plan is based on this initial trading price. The lower the price of the spin-off, the lower the exercise price of the incentive option. E.g., if a spin-off initially trades at $5 per share, management receives the right to buy shares at $5. An $8 initial price would require management to pay $8 for their stock. In these situations, it is to management's benefit to promote interest in the spin-off stock after the price is set by the market, not before. In other words, don't expect bullish pronouncements or presentations about a new spin-off until a price has been established for management's incentive stock options. This price can be set after a day of trading, a week, a month, or more. Sometimes a management's silence about the merits of a new spin-off may not be bad news. In some cases, this silence may actually be golden. If you are attracted to a particular spin-off situation, It may pay to check out the SEC filings for information about when the pricing of management's stock options is to be set. In a situation where management's option package is substantial, it may be a good idea to establish a portion of your stock position before management becomes incentivized to start promoting the new spin-off's stock. Eventually, management and shareholders will be playing on the same team. But it's often helpful to know when the game begins. There are very few investment areas where insiders have such one-sided control in creating a new publicly traded company. Because of this unique quality, analyzing the actions and motives of insiders in spin-off situations is of particular benefit. Since all shareholders of a parent company either receive shares in a new spin-off or have the equal right to buy shares in a new spin-off, there are few fairness issues that come up when dividing assets and liabilities between parent and spin-off. There are, however, ways that insiders can use their relatively unchecked ability to set the structure and terms of a spin-off to gain an advantage for themselves. Of course, by focusing on the motives of management and other insiders, you can turn this advantage for insiders into an advantage for yourself. This is particularly true when it comes to analyzing this next method of establishing a new spin-off company. Buy all rights. Occasionally, instead of merely distributing the shares in a spin-off to shareholders free of charge, a parent company may give its shareholders the right to buy stock in one of its subsidiaries or divisions. One way to accomplish this is through something called a rights offering. Most rights offerings, at least the type that most investors are familiar with, do not involve spin-offs. However, on the rare occasions that a rights offering is used to effect a spin-off, it is worthwhile to pay extra close attention. Why? Come on, you should know this one by now. Oh, all right. Psst. Because you can make a lot of money. A rights offering is most commonly used when a company seeks to raise additional capital. In the usual case, rights are distributed to a company's current shareholders. These rights, together with cash or securities, allow shareholders to purchase additional shares, usually at a discount to the current market price. By giving all shareholders the right, but not the obligation, to buy stock at a discounted price, a company can raise needed capital while giving all shareholders an equal chance to buy the newly issued stock. If current shareholders choose to participate in the rights offering by exercising their right to buy additional stock, their interests are not diluted by the company's sale of new stock at a low price. Alternatively, if shareholders do not wish to purchase additional stock, they can often sell the rights they've received to participate in the bargain purchase on the open market. Rights that are not exercised or sold expire worthless after a set time period. Rights offerings are also unhappily familiar to owners of closed-end funds. Closed-end funds, whether equity or bond funds, are like mutual funds, except that the amount of fund shares issued is fixed. E.g., 20 million shares are sold at $10 per share in a public offering, and those 20 million shares are bought and sold just like a common stock. One way for a closed-end fund to raise additional capital, and thereby raise the fund manager's advisory fees, is to issue more shares through a rights offering. As a general rule, only the fund manager of the closed-end fund benefits from this type of rights offering. But now for the good news. When it comes to the spin-off area, rights offerings can be an extraordinary opportunity for enterprising investors like you. Rights offerings are obscure and often confusing. Throw in the neglect and disinterest displayed by most institutional investors towards spin-offs, and you have an explosive combination. Generally, a parent company will distribute to its shareholders rights, free of charge, to buy shares in a spin-off. Holders of the rights will then have the right to buy shares in the spin-off for the next 30 or 60 days at a fixed dollar price, or for a specified amount of other securities. The rights are usually transferable, which means that shareholders who do not wish to purchase shares of the spin-off can sell their rights in the open market, and investors who are not shareholders of the parent can participate in the rights offering by buying rights in the marketplace. The timing, terms, and details of each rights offering are different. The important thing to remember is this. Anytime you read about a spinoff being accomplished through a rights offering, stop whatever you're doing and take a look. Don't worry, they're quite rare. Just looking will already put you in an elite, though strange, group. But, more important, you will be concentrating your efforts in an area even more potentially lucrative than ordinary spinoffs. You won't have to waste too much effort either. Before you get knee-deep into the intricacies of a particular situation, a quick examination of some superficial aspects of the rights offering and the motives of insiders will either get you excited enough to do some more work or persuade you to spend your time elsewhere. So why does combining a spin-off with a rights offering create such a profitable opportunity? After all, the bargain element of a standard spin-off, indiscriminate selling of the unwanted spin-off stock by parent company shareholders, is not present in a rights offering. In fact, in a rights offering, almost the opposite takes place. Shareholders who use their rights to purchase shares are actually making an affirmative choice to buy stock in the new spin-off. Even the bargain element of a standard rights offering is not present in this situation. Unlike the usual rights offering, the rights do not ensure a bargain purchase. This is because, at the time of the offering, it is not known whether the spin-off will trade above or below the purchase price set in the rights offering. So where does the profit opportunity come from? The answer lies in the very nature of a rights offering. If stock in a new spin-off is sold by the parent company through a rights offering, the parent company has, by definition, chosen not to pursue other alternatives. These alternatives could have included selling the spin-off's businesses to another company, or selling the spin-off to the public at large through an underwritten public offering, both of which require the directors of the parent company, as fiduciaries, to seek the highest price possible for selling the spin-off's assets. But if the parent company uses a rights offering to sell the spin-off company to its own shareholders, there is no need to seek the highest possible price. In fact, limiting initial buyers of the spin-off to parent company shareholders and to investors who purchase rights in the open market is not usually the best way to maximize proceeds from the sale of the spin-off's businesses. However, in a rights offering, since all shareholders of the parent have an equal opportunity to purchase stock in the spin-off, even if a bargain sale is made, shareholders have been treated equally and fairly. While there is a general tendency for a spin-off to be offered at an attractive price in a rights offering, note, investors who buy rights in the open market must add the purchase price of the rights to the offering price to figure out their total cost. Examining the structure of a rights offering can give important additional clues. One telltale sign of a bargain offering price is the inclusion of oversubscription privileges in a rights offering. Oversubscription privileges give investors who purchase spin-off stock in the rights offering the right to buy additional spin-off shares if the rights offering is not fully subscribed. Since rights are obscure, require the payment of additional consideration, and usually trade illiquidly for small sums of money relative to the value of parent company holdings, there are often times when rights holders neither exercise nor sell their rights. In a case where rights to buy 3 million shares are distributed, but rights to buy 1 million shares expire unused, oversubscription privileges allow those rights holders who purchase stock in the offering an additional opportunity to purchase the remaining 1 million shares on a pro rata basis. Insiders who wish to increase their percentage ownership in a new spin-off at a bargain price can do so by including oversubscription privileges in the rights offering. In certain cases, insiders may be required to disclose their intention to oversubscribe for shares in the new spin-off in the SEC filings. The implications of this type of disclosure are obvious. Keep one more point in mind. When oversubscription privileges are involved, the less publicized the rights offering, and the lower the trading price of the rights, the less likely it is for rights holders to purchase stock in the rights offering, and the better the opportunity for insiders and enterprising investors to pick up spin-off shares at a bargain price. While we could review other ways the rights offering process can result in big spin-off profits, it is more important to remember one simple concept. No matter how a transaction is structured, if you can figure out what's in it for the insiders, you will have discovered one of the most important keys to selecting the best spin-off opportunities. In this next example, one of the most complicated and lucrative spin-off transactions of all time, practically the only way to figure out what was going on was to keep a close eye on the insiders. In fact, the spin-off was structured in such a complex and uninviting fashion that I wondered whether the insiders had actually planned it that way. While I usually try to avoid investment situations that are difficult to understand, in this case there was a good reason to make an exception. After I determined that insiders had every reason to hope I wouldn't buy stock in the new spin-off, I had every reason to put in the time and effort required to understand what was happening. While this situation may be too complex for most investors, that's not the important point. Even the experts blew this one. The only point you really need to take away is this. Don't forget to check out the motives of insiders. That point should come through loud and clear. So, let's see how to make some real money. Case study. Liberty Media Telecommunications. Question. How do you make $500 million in less than 2 years? Answer. Start with $50 million and ask John Malone. He did it. John Malone, CEO of Telecommunications, took advantage of the spin-off process to create a situation that proved to be one of the great spin-off opportunities of all time. Anyone who participated in the Liberty Media rights offering, a spin-off from Telecommunications, was able to earn 10 times his initial investment in less than 2 years. Although all shareholders of Telecommunications, TCI, the parent company, had an equal opportunity to participate in the rights offering, and the whole world had the ability to purchase these same rights, the offering was artfully designed to create the most upside potential for those who participated, while simultaneously discouraging most investors from taking advantage of the opportunity. The entire spin-off was followed closely by the Wall Street Journal, much of it on the front page. Yet almost everyone in the investment community missed the chance to make a quick fortune. Hopefully, the next time an opportunity like this rolls around, everyone will pass right by it again. Everyone, that is, except for you. The whole scenario began in January 1990. Telecommunications, the country's largest cable operator, announced its preliminary intention to spin off its programming assets, like QVC and the Family Channel, and some of its minority interests in cable television systems, assets estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion. The announcement was made in response to continuing pressure from Washington to lessen the influence of large cable operators, and telecommunications in particular, on the cable industry. Under the leadership of John Malone, telecommunications had become a behemoth in the industry, wielding its considerable power to, among other things, dictate which program providers would be carried on its cable systems and on what terms. Due to its size, almost 25% of all cable households, TCI was often in a position to make or break the launch of a new cable channel, and in some cases, to use its clout to purchase equity interests in new channels. In response to what was perceived to be Malone's tight control over the industry, one proposal much discussed in Washington was legislation to limit the ability of cable system operators to own interests in program providers. The stated hope of the spin-off was to alleviate some of the pressure from Washington, and to give telecommunications greater flexibility by separating the company's programming assets from its controlled cable systems. The other announced reason for the spin-off was more typical: shareholder value. The hope was that the spin-off would highlight the value of the parent company's ownership stakes in programming assets and its minority stakes in other cable systems. It was thought that these stakes had been lost amid TCI's large portfolio of cable properties. In March of 1990, the Wall Street Journal reported a new development. Rather than proceed with a usual spin-off, Telecommunications had chosen to use a rights offering to effect the spin-off of its programming and other cable properties. Shareholders were to receive rights that would entitle them to exchange some of their TCI stock for shares in the new company. The rights offering was selected primarily for tax reasons. If a rights offering is structured correctly, shareholders are only taxed based on the value of the rights received. The March announcement also disclosed something else. The spin-off would not be nearly as large as initially suggested. TCI was no longer planning to spin off its $1 billion stake in Turner Broadcasting. In October 1990, just before the preliminary SEC filings were made, the distribution of telecommunications' 50% stake in the Discovery Channel was also taken off the table. The value of the entity to be spun off had shrunk to well under 50% of original expectations. In fact, SEC filings made in November of 1990 and revised in January 1991 disclosed that the estimated value of the assets to be spun off into the new entity, Liberty Media, were down to approximately $600 million. As TCI had a total market capitalization of approximately $15 billion, about $6 billion of equity value and $9 billion in debt, the size of the Liberty spinoff was going to represent a drop in the bucket relative to the whole of telecommunications. In other words, Liberty was going to be an unimportant sideshow as far as most institutional investors were concerned, and potentially a classic spinoff opportunity for us. According to newspaper accounts in January 1991, Liberty's portfolio of assets was going to include minority interests in 14 cable franchises, serving 1.6 million subscribers, and interests in 26 other entities, including 11 regional sports networks, as well as minority interests in the Family Channel, American Movie Classics, Black Entertainment Television, and the QVC Shopping Network. These assets were estimated by telecommunications to have a value of approximately $600 million, more or less equally divided between cable and programming interests. The Wall Street Journal reported that Liberty will be a much smaller company than some had expected, issuing only about 2 million shares. On a fully diluted basis, telecommunications has about 415 million shares outstanding. According to the journal, analysts described the almost 400-page prospectus as one of the most complex transactions of its kind, and a cause of confusion to investors. Due to the exclusion of TCI's interests in Turner Broadcasting and the Discovery Channel, some analysts felt that Liberty may be perceived as a less attractive investment. The journal went on to report, on a pro forma basis, for the 9 months ended September 30, 1990, Liberty reported a loss of $20.4 million after a preferred stock dividend requirement, and a $9.77 a share loss. In sum, the picture of Liberty painted for most investors did not exactly shout, "Come on in, the water's fine." If this basic description wasn't discouraging enough, there was still plenty more to come. Telecommunications shareholders were to receive one transferable right for every 200 shares they owned. Each right, together with 16 shares of telecommunications, could then be exchanged for one share of Liberty Media. The rights expired after 30 days. At a price of $16 for a share of TCI, this translated to a purchase price of $256 per share of Liberty. 16 shares of TCI at $16 each. As stated, there were approximately 415 million fully diluted shares of TCI, a distribution of one right to buy one share of Liberty for every 200 TCI shares held translated into the approximately 2.1 million shares of Liberty to be issued. For an institution that owned stock in a corporation with over 400 million shares, a stock with a capitalization of only 2 million shares would generally be considered not only risky and inappropriate, but entirely too illiquid to be included in its portfolio. A price of over $250 per share is also considered very awkward. Very few institutions would be willing to trade a very liquid stock with over 400 million shares outstanding for a small amount of a very illiquid stock. a search through the SEC filings for an explanation for the desire to have only 2 million shares of Liberty outstanding, priced at $256 per share, as opposed to a more usual 20 million shares, priced at approximately $26, or 40 million shares priced around $13, revealed the following clarification. The exchange rates at which shares of Liberty stock will be issued in exchange for TCI stock were selected solely for the purpose of limiting the aggregate number of shares of Liberty common stock initially to be issued to a maximum of approximately 2 million shares. The exchange rates are not intended to be any indicator of the value of Liberty securities. My translation? We picked 2 million shares because we wanted Liberty stock to appear unattractive to TCI shareholders. Why do I say this? What advantage was there for Liberty to appear unattractive? For starters, the rights offering was structured so that the amount of Liberty shares issued would be equal to the amount of rights exercised. In other words, if only 1 million rights were exercised to purchase Liberty stock, only 1 million shares of Liberty would be issued, not the theoretical maximum of 2 million shares if all TCI holders exercised their right to purchase stock. A sale of 1 million shares in exchange for $256 worth of TCI stock would equal a purchase price of $256 million for all of the common equity in Liberty Media, instead of a potential $512 million cost if all 2 million shares were purchased. Since Liberty would still own the same assets, regardless of whether 1 million shares of common stock were issued or 2 million shares, anyone primarily interested in Liberty's upside potential would much prefer to split that potential among fewer shares. The deal had still another twist. Any common stock, the stock entitled to all upside appreciation in the value of Liberty, not sold in the rights offering, would be replaced by preferred stock to be owned by telecommunications. Since, as stated, TCI was transferring the same assets to Liberty regardless of whether $250 million worth of Liberty stock was sold or $500 million, this $250 million shortfall was to be made up through the issuance of $250 million of Liberty preferred stock to TCI. The terms of the preferred stock to be issued were very advantageous to Liberty. The bottom line was, the fewer shareholders that participated in the Liberty offering, the more leveraged the upside potential for Liberty's stock. Better still, this leveraged upside would be achieved not through the issuance of debt, but through the issuance of low-cost preferred stock. Since this preferred stock required no cash payments for 15 years, carried a low rate of 6%, and had a fixed redemption price, i.e. no upside potential, this was clearly an attractive way to achieve the benefits of leverage for Liberty common stock, without the risks of taking on debt. What were TCI's insiders doing in the midst of all this confusion? For one thing, they weren't giving away free advice. According to the Wall Street Journal, telecommunications' top two executives, Chairman Bob Magnus and President John Malone, have advised the company they each currently intend to exercise at least 50% of their exchange rights. Certainly not a rousing endorsement. But if you looked a bit closer, there were some helpful hints available. In the prospectus issued for the rights offering, located under the heading Executive Compensation, the following statement was found. Pursuant to Dr. Malone's employment agreement, in lieu of cash compensation for his services to Liberty, Dr. Malone will be granted non-transferable options to purchase 100,000 shares of Liberty stock at a price per share equal to $256. This translated to an option, not including any shares of Liberty purchased by Malone in the rights offering, for over $25 million worth of Liberty stock. Since, according to the same SEC filing, Malone owned approximately $50 million worth of TCI stock, the success of Liberty was going to be of material significance even to John Malone. If 2 million shares of Liberty were issued, an option on 100,000 shares was equal to an option on 5% of the total company. At 1 million shares of Liberty outstanding, this translated to a 10% share of Liberty's upside. Looking a bit further, Liberty wasn't nearly as bad off as the newspaper summaries made it appear. The pro forma loss of $9.77 per share for the most recent nine-month period wasn't the whole story. The earnings, or lack of earnings, shown in the pro forma statements included the operations of only a very small portion of Liberty's assets. Since the bulk of Liberty's assets were made up of equity stakes in other companies, the revenues and earnings of most of these interests were not consolidated into Liberty's income statement. These stakes merely appeared on Liberty's balance sheet at cost. Even Forbes magazine, which I enjoy reading, completely blew it, citing Liberty's low level of revenues and earnings. I guess they didn't read the SEC filing. Forbes stated, "If you're a TCI shareholder, pass on the swap," exchanging TCI shares for Liberty shares through the rights offering. "If you're considering buying Liberty stock, don't chase it." So while it's great to read business publications to find new ideas, it still pays to remember rule number one. Do your own work. I'm sorry, but this work does include at least reading the pro forma financial statements. There was something else about Liberty that looked very exciting. According to the prospectus, management of TCI had the expectation that Liberty's common stock will initially represent only an interest in any future growth of Liberty. What was this worth? Well, let's see. Telecommunications held approximately $15 billion of cable assets. Liberty was going to be controlled by the same group of managers as telecommunications. Liberty was set up as a vehicle for TCI's programming ventures. If John Malone was going to receive a big chunk of Liberty's upside, maybe TCI could use some of its considerable muscle to help out little Liberty. Certainly, a new cable channel might benefit from cutting Liberty in for a piece of its equity. Perhaps this would help the new channel's chances of being carried over telecommunications' vast cable network. Maybe Liberty could start up its own cable channels. These new cable channels would also have a huge head start if made available to all of TCI's subscribers. So how many ways would all this upside be split? The answer was, it depended on how many of telecommunications shareholders decided to use their rights to exchange shares of TCI for shares of Liberty. One press report summed up the general consensus nicely. Liberty's problems include an illiquid stock, a terribly complicated asset and capital structure, and lack of initial cash flow from its investments. A Bear Stearns analyst added, "We view this offer as having very limited appeal for most fund managers." Shearson Lehman stated, "To give up TCI to participate in Liberty, a highly uncertain value with limited liquidity, doesn't strike us an especially good trade at virtually any price for most institutional investors." It should have been no surprise then, when only about 36% of eligible rights to buy Liberty stock were exercised, resulting in only slightly more than 700,000 Liberty shares of a possible 2 million being issued. The rights to buy shares in Liberty for $256 worth of TCI stock were freely traded and could have been purchased by anyone who so desired for a period of 30 days. The rights were available at a price of less than $1 per right, meaning the owner of 200 shares of TCI, $3,000 of TCI stock, received a right worth less than $1. Most shareholders of TCI neither exercised nor sold their rights. Of course, telecommunications' top two executives, Bob Magnus and John Malone, did end up exercising all of their rights to buy shares in Liberty after all. Together with his 100,000 options, Malone had been able to keep nearly 20% of Liberty's upside for himself, compared with his participation in less than 2% of TCI's upside. Although CEO of both entities, Malone was clearly incentivized to use TCI's considerable clout in the cable industry to make sure that Liberty thrived. Then again, all TCI shareholders had had an equal opportunity to participate in Liberty's future, even if they weren't exactly led by the hand. According to Multichannel News, a publication covering the cable industry, TCI officials expected fewer than 50% of the eligible shares to participate. But as TCI disclosed details of the plan, Wall Street soured on Liberty's illiquid stock, complicated asset and capital structure, and lack of initial cash flow. John Malone, chairman of Liberty and president and CEO of TCI, said he was indifferent to, not disappointed by, Wall Street's lack of enthusiasm, even though Liberty's shareholder meetings can be held in one telephone booth. Malone said that in structuring the deal, TCI